from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Medical patients who in the past took antibiotics and were cured are increasingly vulnerable to complications as drug-resistant bacteria spread, making formerly easy-to-treat conditions potentially deadly.
We are facing a breaking point, and the reason for that is that the bacteria and the fungi and the parasites in our environment are mutating so rapidly that they are figuring out ways to destroy even the best new antibiotics that we throw at them.
Coming up, we talk with Dr. Matt McCarthy, author of Superbugs, The Race to Stop an Epidemic, all about the problem of drug-resistant microbes and the race to find a solution. That's next, after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Deadly superbugs, or microbes that can resist antibiotics, are on the rise, annually killing hundreds of thousands of people, typically those with compromised immune systems. Pharmaceutical companies, however, aren't financially incentivized to find new superbug-fighting drugs. Physician Matt McCarthy's new book, Superbugs, The Race to Stop an Epidemic, chronicles this conflict from his firsthand perspective as an infectious disease doctor. We're going to talk with Dr. McCarthy this hour about these superbugs and the threats they pose and what solutions are on the horizon. And Matt McCarthy, welcome to the Forum program. Good to have you aboard.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
I guess the place I'd like to begin with you is, there's a fairly new British study out that cites 2050 as having the possibility of 10 million people dying by these superbugs. It's now about 8 million and counting with cancer. And it's extraordinary how vast and how difficult this problem is and how, well, the pharmaceutical companies haven't really lifted many fingers to help here. But first of all, give us an update as best you can on, because there's been a surge of superbugs in the news recently, on where we are.
Yeah, well, I think the first thing that's useful to do is to define our terms. So superbugs, to some people, just mean drug-resistant bacteria. But to those of us who treat patients for a living, it actually has a much more broad meaning. Superbugs are drug-resistant fungi, parasites, bacteria, viruses. And when you look at all of these organisms in our environment that are now resistant to the treatments we've relied upon for generations, the scope of the problem is substantial. And in fact, that World Health Organization projection says that by 2050, this is going to be a bigger killer than heart disease or cancer. And so the perplexing part of this is, why would the pharmaceutical industry be pulling away from this clearly when there's a market and a demand and a need? And we can get into why those reasons are, but it really comes down to the fact that the treatments are often not profitable.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
right. And so the question is, how do we incentivize them to actually care? In my book, I quote a pharmaceutical CEO who says that he has an ethical mandate to charge as much money as possible for new drugs because he's fundamentally accountable to shareholders and not patients. And that's a tough thing to swallow when you're in the emergency room every day seeing patients who have infections for which there are very few treatment options left.
Well, you've been there. You've been in the trenches, and that's a lot of what your book is about. And I want to certainly talk about your experience and get what we can from it. But not all superbugs, and you use the broad generic category here, including fungi, like you said, and so forth, they really hit the most vulnerable populations. I mean, and we're not only talking about populations in the developing world, but we're talking about people with immune problems or compromised immune systems.
You're exactly right. I mean, this is one of the questions I get most commonly. People want to know, are they at risk for superbugs? And if not, why not? And if so, why? And it turns out that not everyone has the same risk for picking these things up. People who have impaired immune systems are at much higher risk. And the thing that I've discovered is that not everyone knows the state of their immune system. And so a good starting point is just to talk with your doctor and say, how's my immune system? It turns out that many patients have medical conditions that subtly impair or alter their immune system and predispose them to infections. And then there is another subset of patients who are on medications that weaken the immune system, and they don't even realize it. I have see patients every single day who are on a drug called prednisone, which at certain doses can predispose you to all kinds of infections. And people don't always know that. And it's not, you know, it's one of these things that the more you know, the more you can protect yourself from these things. Because as I discuss, these things, these superbugs are all around us.
We're talking to Dr. Matt McCarthy. He's the author of Superbugs, The Race to Stop an Epidemic. And as much of a problem there is in somehow getting insurance companies, getting pharmaceutical companies, big pharma, to get involved in this, there's also been a huge drop in the training of those experts like you who work with infectious diseases. It's, I think, only nephrology is close, about a 40% drop. So you've got all these dearth of physician specialists, and infectious disease is a big problem.
Well, and my wife is a nephrologist, so we certainly appreciate the challenge of recruiting young doctors to go into these specialized fields. I actually had an op-ed in the New York Times pointing this out, that we talk all about the superbugs that are coming for us and how the pharmaceutical industry is losing interest in treating these types of infections, but so are doctors. I mean, this is what's so wild about this, is that when I was a medical student, we looked at infectious disease specialists as the smartest doctors in the hospital, the most caring doctors, the ones who were there the latest at night in working with the homeless patients and the ones with HIV. And there's been this subtle shift over my career where fewer and fewer doctors are interested in pursuing this line of work. And it really couldn't be coming at a worse time because I can tell you, when I walk into the emergency room every morning for my job, half of the patients that I'm seeing are there because they have an infection. And we desperately need more people who are interested in caring for these types of patients. But they're losing interest for the same reason that the pharmaceutical industry is losing interest, which is that infectious disease doctors tend to be paid less than almost every other type of doctor. And that's something that I have been arguing for a change, a restructuring in how we compensate physicians.
What about fear, though? I mean, there are a lot of medical professionals. In fact, you write about, you know, the apprehension and terror almost that you experience sometimes because these patients have the possibility of communicating, so to speak, their disease to you as a medical professional.
Well, that's a risk that we take every day, but we don't take lightly. There are very sophisticated precautions that we take so that we don't contract any of the conditions that our patients have. And I'll tell you, I have two young children, and when I go home at night, I'm not worried that I'm going to be transmitting some infection to them. And that's because we have protocols that we follow. And I take care of people with superbugs every single day. And I'm confident that I'm going to cure them and that when I get home, I'm not going to be posing a threat or a danger to my family or my neighbors.
Well, let's talk, though, about something that you write about, and because you mentioned fungi or fungi. People, you know, it's like tomato and tomato, pronouncing it different ways. But the threat of Candida auris, which is C. auris, it's known as, it's a fungus, and it's hard to detect. We were just talking about a fungus in the last segment of the program. We're not even sure where it's from. It's incredibly invasive, and just about everything that's done to protect from a contamination has not really succeeded. And this is stuff that they were trying to get out of the ceiling, and they were trying to get out of the floors and so forth. So when medical professionals go in, they are pretty vulnerable in a case like that, aren't they?
Well, you know, you bring up Candida auris, which is a yeast infection, and that's what I have dedicated my life to studying. My wife sometimes jokes when she says, of all the guys in the world, how did I end up with the yeast infection guy? But that's what I focus my time on, and I'm the editor of a journal called Current Fungal Infection Reports, and we have been writing about Candida auris and talking about the need for new treatments for years. This was an organism that was found in the ear canal of a woman in Japan in 2008 and quickly spread around the world. And honestly, nobody really cared about it until it appeared on the front page of the New York Times in the first week of April. And I was quoted in that article because I've treated a lot of patients who have Candida auris. And I think one of the really interesting aspects of this is that after that article appeared, I was asked to comment about this organism. And it made people in the hospital very nervous because they did not want the facility that I work at to be labeled as a place that's infested with superbugs or with a deadly fungus. The irony here is that the best hospitals in the country tend to see more of these superbugs because we have the most sophisticated diagnostic techniques. We have the most powerful antibiotics, and we have the experts who know how to treat them.
And forgive me, Dr. McCarthy, isn't there also some concern for these hospitals? And it's become a real issue about disclosing information. I mean, the CDC, for example, can't disclose a hospital where there's been an outbreak of a superbug.
Absolutely. I know I wrote an op-ed in the Times about that as well. And the first line of it is I say that hospitals are losing an important PR battle. And that's because there is this secrecy surrounding the disclosure of what we're finding. And the problem here is that we need to respect our audience. But frankly, hospital administrators are concerned that if we start disclosing all of the superbugs that we see and treat on a given day, it'll freak patients out, and that they would avoid medical care rather than coming into an emergency room. And that's a mistake. I've treated patients who have Candida auris. I've cured all of them, and I have not transmitted it to anyone else. I haven't transmitted it to myself. And if you have an infection, we have in our department the world experts in Candida auris. You want to come to our hospital. And it's hard to convey that in a way that doesn't spread fear or alarm, because there are a lot of people who say to me, my mom's getting older. I'm thinking of putting her in a nursing home, and I'd like to know if that place has superbugs or not. And so the reason I wrote my book and the reason that I enjoy talking about this is I like educating people about what the real dangers are, what the perceived threats are, and what you can do to protect yourself.
Well, one of the things we can protect ourselves with is more transparency from hospitals, as I think you've just indicated, and also from state governments when outbreaks of the kind we're talking about take place. Let's talk about some of your work, though. I mean, you're involved in some clinical trials. Dr. Tom Walsh, I guess, is your mentor in this. Mm-hmm. You had a national conference, on the 20th? It was about MRSA mainly, wasn't it, on the 20th of June?
Yep. Yep, and we've been talking about, all of these new treatments for superbugs. And what I like to do is I find new antibiotics and I find new treatments that people aren't really using. And I say, hey, is there a way that we could use this that would benefit patients in a way that might be unexpected? And that was the theme of my book, is that we are trying to find promising new treatment strategies that maybe have been overlooked, and can we replicate these in other hospitals? And we just presented our results at a conference, and we'll be doing that more through the fall. And I think one of the things to excite people about is that, there's a lot of anxiety around superbugs, but the truly wonderful and exciting thing is that we're discovering new antibiotics to treat them all the time. And one of the most interesting things for me is where we're finding these drugs. It turns out that beneath our feet in the soil is this rich and wonderful place to discover new drugs. And the reason for that is that there are all of these bacteria and fungi that are in the soil that are playing this subterranean warfare where it's a Darwinian survival of the fittest. And these bacteria are secreting chemicals to kill all of the other bacteria in their environment. And if you can pluck one of those chemicals out, you've got yourself an antibiotic that was specifically designed to kill other bacteria.
And boy, we need new antibiotics, don't we?
Yes. And the challenge, of course, is how do you find that drug without sifting through the needle in a haystack and going on the proverbial goose chase where you spend $1 billion looking and you don't find anything. And so what I like looking at is how we're using artificial intelligence and big data to find that next promising new drug.
I think we should go into the oceans, too, as well as the soil on my own, because there's all kinds of things down there that we don't even know about yet with different
Absolutely.
Kinds of powers along these lines. But aren't they using viruses and bacteria to attack superbugs, for example, over in the UK?
Yes, you hit on something that's fascinating. We have discovered that viruses called bacteriophages can specifically kill various forms of bacteria. And in May of this past 6 weeks ago, it was reported that a cocktail of three different bacteriophages was used to treat a 15-year-old girl from England who had this drug-resistant infection that simply wouldn't go away with standard antibiotics. And they were able to use a cocktail that had been edited with this molecular scalpel called CRISPR. And it was kind of this revolutionary new approach to treating infections, even though we've known about bacteriophages for decades. The challenge is, when you see that there is this new discovery, the challenge is how do you get that accessible to all the patients who have that type of infection? Because bacteriophages are very narrow spectrum. They treat a specific type of bacteria, and that's hard to turn a profit on. And so when you hear about these bacteria-destroying viruses, the question I have is, how do we get this mass-produced in a way that will benefit patients and it will incentivize the production of more of these things? That's going to be a complicated situation to address, and one we can discuss a little more, how the various financial incentives to make that dream a reality.
Well, we've done programs on CRISPR. Mm-hmm. In fact, I was involved in an international meeting about CRISPR, and I'm wondering if you're feeling that that really is a particularly strong sense of hope here. It's gene editing, essentially, we're talking about when we're talking about CRISPR.
It is tremendously exciting. We have the chance to fundamentally alter the nucleic acids and alter even the human genome. The challenge is that there are ethical hurdles. You can change what it means to be a human being. You could insert rabbit DNA into a human being, and it wouldn't be that hard. And then there are financial hurdles, that you can use CRISPR to design a specific type of virus to make bacteria explode. But it will cost over $1 billion to prove that that's safe and effective for all patients. And we have to figure out who's going to take that risk, because many of the different treatments for superbugs end up failing. And increasingly, the big pharma is saying, you know what, this risk is simply just not worth it.
We're talking to Dr. Matt McCarthy, and again, his book, and he's staff physician at New York Presbyterian Hospital and assistant professor of medicine at Weill Cornell Medical College. He's also the author of a book called Superbugs, A Race to Stop an Epidemic, and wondering if there's some hope in the fact that across the country we have some pretty intricate tracking systems for epidemiology.
Oh, it's extraordinary what we're able to do to keep track of this stuff. We've got people at the NIH, and we have people who are specifically spend their days looking at how bacteria spread from one person to another, both in the hospital and outside of it. One of the challenges we have is that states don't have to report all of the infections that they see, and that when there's an outbreak of a superbug, there is not mandatory reporting on that. The disclosure arrangements vary state by state. And so one of the things I've been pushing for is more transparency, so that the CDC or the NIH has more information about how these various superbugs are spreading from one person to another. Because once we understand that, we can come up with containment strategies and protocols that will protect future generations and future patients. So that's a big hurdle we have right now, is that the states have a lot of say in what they disclose about the various infections that they encounter. And that's something that we unquestionably need to change. The question is, was the political will there to work on something like that?
You had mentioned crops before and pesticides, I believe. How much do we know there in terms of superbugs?
Well, one of the interesting questions somebody asked me the other day was, they said, you know how locusts were thrust upon the earth as a judgment for human behavior? Is the same thing true about superbugs? And the question caught me off guard.
It's a theological question. Yeah.
A theological. And I said, well, you know, human behavior has actually caused many of the superbugs that we have because of inappropriate use of the antibiotics. And that happens on a small scale, with doctors like me prescribing antibiotics when I shouldn't, and when patients taking them in ways that they should not. For example, if you're prescribed 7 days of a treatment and you only take 2 days and you stop taking the treatment because you feel better, that allows the bacteria to mutate and evolve and become superbugs. So that's sort of the small scale. But then on the larger scale, we have misused antibiotics in commercial agriculture and farming and in meat-producing animals. And as you mentioned with the agriculture, one of the things that we do is we use some of our syphilis drugs and tuberculosis drugs in orange groves. And I grew up in Florida, where the orange crops are very important, but they're not that important. And the fact that we are exposing the microbes that are in the environment and in the orange groves to these precious drugs is a mistake. There's a powerful lobbying effort behind that to maintain the use of antibiotics there. But they're not alone. There's also very powerful fungicides that are used in the tulip gardens in the Netherlands and in Central America. And scientists have studied the soil surrounding these tulip gardens and found that there are superbugs there. So we have to be much more careful about where and when we use antibiotics. And the idea of just spraying them in the environment to, you know, sterilize the soil is a bad idea, and it's not going to help things.
Well, we've been warned about the overuse of antibiotics now for decades. I mean, but as someone said to me recently, it remains gluttonous in terms of the use of antibiotics.
Well, we've gotten a little bit better. In meat-producing animals, for example, we used to pump pigs and chickens and cows full of antibiotics, and it led to all sorts of superbugs. We've gotten better at that, and I think awareness is really the first step. You know, a lot of people have compared the evolution or the development of superbugs to global warming, where it's one of these things that we know it's a problem, and we sort of push it off or blame other people for it and just say, oh, something should be done. But really, we all play a role in this. And, you know, another area where we're trying to get better about antibiotic use is in dentistry. There's a study that says that 80% of antibiotics given to dental patients are inappropriate. And so we're trying to curb the use in a way that's responsible and doesn't affect patients in a way that would be bad.
Well, there's a lot to talk about here, and we do welcome your involvement in the program with Dr. Matt McCarthy, who's with us, author of Superbugs, A Race to Stop an Epidemic, and as if we don't have enough to worry about with climate change and wildfires and earthquakes, nuclear arms. We certainly have to worry about this, but there are some hopeful signs, and we'd like to hear your questions and any comments you might have, and you can join us by dialing into our toll-free number. That number, 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, and you can get in touch with us on Facebook as well. We're @KQED Forum. Let's go to a caller, and let's begin with you. Jane, you're on the air. Welcome, Jane.
Hi, I was wondering what we can do as patients and as parents when we're in the doctor's office and our son or ourselves are prescribed an antibiotic where we don't actually think it's appropriate. I recently took my son in after having a couple days of fevers and, you know, mildly complaining of a sore throat, but I could tell he didn't have strep because we've had strep before. And the office test for strep came back negative, but they still prescribed us what seemed like pretty strong antibiotics, like a pretty strong 3-day dose of antibiotics while we were waiting for further testing from the lab. And I, you know, you're just kind of put in this position where you're supposed to trust the doctor, but at the same time, you know, we hear all this about the antibiotic resistance, and I didn't want to do it, but I still did it. And then it ended up that lab test came back negative for strep as well. So we gave our son, you know, these what seemed like really strong antibiotics for nothing.
Let me thank you for that call, Jane. We're coming up on a break. Matt McCarthy, quick response from you. What people can do in a situation like Jane's described?
Well, Jane poses what I think is such a challenging and interesting question here. It all comes down to trust. If you can't trust the doctor who's taking care of you or your family, you've got nothing. And we can talk more about how to prescribe antibiotics appropriately. But that's a case where the antibiotic didn't need to be given. And that puts the parent in a very difficult situation.
Yeah, and Jane, I thank you for the call. We're seconds away from a break here. But Stephen wants to know, why are infectious disease doctors paid less than other doctors? How is their pay determined?
It has to do with something called RVUs, and physicians are largely compensated based on the procedures that they do, not on intellectual expertise. And infectious disease doctors don't really do procedures.
We will return with Dr. Matt McCarthy. Stay tuned for more. He's the author of Superbugs, A Race to Stop an Epidemic. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Dr. Matt McCarthy. He is staff physician at New York Presbyterian Hospital and also assistant professor of medicine at the Weill Cornell Medical College, author of a book called Superbugs, The Race to Stop an Epidemic. And we are going to get more listener involvement here. Let me go to a caller in Lafayette. Wayne, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hey, hi, doctor. Thanks for taking my call today. I just had a question as to how we can make sure to modify the behavior of the pharmaceutical industry to help in prevention of additional resistance with bacteria?
Very important question. Some thoughts from you, Matt McCarthy.
Well, this is a wonderful question, Wayne. What we are currently trying to do is entice the pharmaceutical industry to stay in the antibiotic business. And the proposals that are on the table are called push incentives and pull incentives. A push incentive would be going to a pharmaceutical company and saying, we'll give you a tax break if you invest some of that excess profit in new antibiotics or in new methods for combating antimicrobial resistance. This is a very popular idea in the pharmaceutical world because it guarantees them more money, and it also guarantees more money going into the pipeline for developing new drugs. The challenge we have with this is going to a company like Johnson & Johnson, who has been very good at making new antibiotics, and giving a tax break to a billion-dollar company like that that is currently on trial for the opioid epidemic and the way that they have manipulated patients and really harmed people. And it's unclear if there's going to be the interest in negotiating with the pharmaceutical industry to try to plead with them to make new drugs. One of the interesting parts is if you talk with leaders at the National Institute of Health, they say, you don't want the federal government to be a pharmaceutical company. These private companies are very good at what they do, and we need to entice them to keep doing it. But there's this increasing push to nationalize the production of antibiotics and to have the government take this over. And people say that antibiotics are like a public good, like electricity or water, and that if the pharmaceutical industry isn't interested in making more of them, well, good riddance. We should pool our resources with the European Union and with other countries around the world, and we should invest in the most promising new drugs, and then we should all share them. That's a nice idea. It's unclear if there's going to be a consensus formed to make that happen. That's a very popular idea in England right now. But a number of people who I've talked to about this say that that will ultimately stifle innovation if you take the private industry out of the antibiotic business, and that it's better for us to negotiate with them. I wrote my book so that people, when they hear about these various proposals, can make an informed decision. And I think you're going to be hearing more about this on the campaign trail in 2020 when some of our political candidates are asked the question of, say, the antibiotic market is broken. What do you want to do to fix it? And we have not heard fully formed proposals from very many of the candidates thus far.
Well, let's hope that comes up in the campaign. And I thank the caller, Wayne. And let me just ask you, Dr. McCarthy, about cheap antibiotics and the fueling of deadly drug-resistant infections. We had, for example, a New York Times article that pointed out what was going on in Kenya, particularly in dispensing drugs without prescriptions in Kiberia and Nairobi. And there's mass production of generics. China, India, for example, cheap. You can get amoxicillin in the developing world for almost nothing. This is a pretty disturbing part of this picture in the grand scheme, isn't it?
It's a huge problem. One of the things we found is with superbugs is the more you look, the more you find. And we don't even know what's going on in many parts of the world. We've found that places where people live very close together, places like New Delhi or in Bangladesh or certain parts of sub-Saharan Africa, those are breeding grounds for superbugs and for the emergence of new deadly new pathogens.
Excuse me, a lot of this has to do with lack of clean water and poor sanitation, doesn't it?
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. And many of those places do not have the same level of oversight that we have, where in my hospital in New York City, if somebody wants to use an antibiotic, especially if it's one of our powerful antibiotics, they have to get permission from somebody called an antibiotic steward. And I've been a steward before, and it's not very fun to be that person. But if a surgeon wants to use, let's hypothetically say, a drug called meropenem, it's a very strong antibiotic, they can't just order it and give it to their patient. They have to ask someone like me if they're allowed to. And sometimes I say no, because we're trying to protect our drugs. And that can be an uncomfortable conversation between two doctors, where one is saying, I need this for my patient, and then the other one is saying, sorry, pick something else. Well, here's what I would recommend instead. And that extra layer with this antibiotic steward further makes it more difficult for the pharmaceutical industry to turn a profit off of their drugs, because not only do they have to spend a lot of money to get them approved, But there's this layer, a firewall, essentially, where doctors are trying to not use them very often, and we're really stingy about doling them out. And so there's an argument that we should not view antibiotics the same way that we view other types of drugs, like a blood pressure medication or a lipid-lowering agent, because they're prescribed so sparingly that's not the same business model, and that we need to entirely revamp the way we compensate companies for producing these drugs.
Talking with Matt McCarthy, he's the author of Superbugs, The Race to Stop an Epidemic, and here's Paul, our next caller. Paul, welcome.
Hi. I'm wondering why this discussion is only highlighting antibiotics and other pharmaceutical products as solutions to this current and future problem. And I'm, you know, just wondering what population is going to be the healthiest, you know, in the future to deal with all these superbugs.
Thoughts from you, Dr. McCarthy?
Paul, it's an interesting question why we're focusing on the pharmaceutical industry and the antibiotics that we have thus far. One of the interesting things for me talking about these drug-resistant microbes around the world is that I've found that people have ideas of treatment options that doctors are not talking about at all. One of them is something called colloidal silver. I've never heard another doctor talk to me about colloidal silver. Yet almost every place I go, a person in the audience will bring it up, or I get letters sent to me saying, have you looked at colloidal silver? And I'll tell you, I'm actually starting to look at it now, because there must be some sort of wisdom in the crowds that this is working for people.
What is it?
And what we do, it's a form of an ion that people have found can cure various forms of infection. And what I have to do is figure out, is this something that there's any evidence to substantiate its use in my patients? And what I like to do is to find these unconventional treatments, and then I have to get permission from my hospital if I want to study them. And this is actually one of the themes, you know, I'm on our ethics committee, is that you can't just as a doctor waltz into a hospital and say, hey, I've got a tube of colloidal silver and I'd like to start giving it to patients. You have to get approval from something called an institutional review board. And that board is tough. They tortured me when I tried to get my trials off the ground. But it's an important level of oversight to safeguard how we study humans. And that's something that I think fascinates me and a lot of my colleagues, is how do we experiment responsibly on other human beings? And I mentioned in one of the patients, I had this thick consent form for a man, and I was going to give him a drug that had never been used in our hospital before. And he was a lawyer, and he was very familiar with reading consent forms. And he put the stack of papers down, and he looked me in the eye, and he said, I just have one question for you. Would you give this drug to your own mother? And it took me back for a second, but the answer was yes. But that was all he needed to know. And I think that, you know, what we wrestle with in medicine is getting consent from patients, but it's not always informed consent. And how do we walk that tightrope without exploiting people?
Well, we could do a whole hour with you just on that question of clinical trials and protocols and informed consent, but here's an idea from a listener. Well, there's a lot of it in your book. There's a listener who says, what about advances toward the use of phagocytes, body cells capable of engulfing and absorbing bacteria? There are millions of phagocytes in our microenvironment. The only challenge is finding the matching phagocytes to the corresponding bacteria.
Oh, that's a great point. And we actually do something like that. Neutrophil transfusions, which are a variation on the phagocytes, where we just have certain patients who have almost no immune system because they've received chemotherapy. And so what happens is the chemo destroys the tumor, but it also destroys the white blood cells, which provide our immune system. And then a patient gets an infection, and they have no immune system to attack the infection. So we will pump them full of neutrophils in an effort to save them. And the same thing has been examined with phagocytes. It's a little bit more difficult because they're such a targeted type of cell to a very specific type of infection. And the question, whenever you hear about a new treatment for superbugs, and you ever wonder to yourself, why isn't this more widely available? It all comes down to cost. That if there is a new treatment that's discovered, it typically takes 10 years of clinical testing and $1 billion in investment to go through testing in test tubes, in animals, in healthy human volunteers. All of that stuff costs so much money. And the companies are increasingly saying, we don't want to do this unless it's going to produce a blockbuster treatment for us, something like Lipitor or Viagra. And we've found with antibiotics, it's just not the same business model. So for phagocytes to get off the ground as a real clinical treatment, it would cost at least $1 billion. And as of right now, no one is really interested in taking that risk.
Here's a listener who writes, if drug companies don't find the development of antibiotics financially attractive, should the federal government take on this research? It could license any technology it develops, requiring modest royalties to recoup part of its costs.
Yeah, it's a great point. You know, I ask Tony Fauci, who is one of the leaders at the National Institute of Health, and he would say, no, 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 trust me, you do not want the federal government getting involved in this. But there is an important op-ed that was written the other day in the New England Journal of Medicine where they're saying we need to nationalize this. We need the federal government to step in. And that when you have something that is by definition a market failure, which antibiotics are, it requires federal intervention to protect patients. And that this is actually a public health crisis.
I see. I think you've just defined it. It is a public health crisis.
Well, it is. And the first step is really educating yourself to understand the scope of the problem so that you can recognize what is a good solution and when people come forward with bad solutions. And that's one of the things that I enjoy doing is giving people the tools so that when you hear somebody stand up and say, I know how to make this work, I know how to cure MRSA, I know how to cure drug-resistant fungi, you can look at them and you can listen to them and you can say, that's not actually a good idea, or that's a great idea. And how do we navigate all of this together?
Well, we'll go to more calls, and we go next to you. Sean, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Well, thank you for having me, and good to talk to you, Dr. McCarthy. My question is regarding the focus on prevention that might not necessarily constitute the use of antibiotics versus therapies that use antibiotics and the development of those antibiotics and how the public and public health agencies should decide where to put the effort to curb antibiotic resistance.
Matt McCarthy.
Sean, it's a great question. There is a new act that was just a bipartisan act called the Disarm Act that was just put forward 2 weeks ago into Congress, and it is a multi-pronged approach to more effectively use antibiotics. It relies upon getting hospitals to implement this stewardship program where you have somebody who's knowledgeable about antibiotics to prevent doctors from inappropriately prescribing these drugs. And it also couples with that resources for epidemiology and for prevention and for all kinds of different methods where we can contain infections and develop targeted treatments. And again, one of the issues is, in addition to, you know, I've been focusing on the antibiotic treatments, but another area where we desperately need more innovation and more investment is in diagnostics. We need better tools to diagnose the superbugs that are in our environment. You know, I mentioned that I'm a yeast infection guy, and many of the fungal infections that we diagnose are actually made today the same way they were 100 years ago, which is that we look under a microscope and we say, does that fungus look like a canoe or like a banana? And based on the shape, we decide what to treat the person with. And that's a very outdated method for, you know, humans in the 21st century. And so what we are constantly trying to remind people is that, yes, we need better treatments, but we also need better molecular diagnostics.
Don't we also need more public awareness on things like sanitation and hygiene and pollution? And we need rapid diagnostics, too, don't we? And vaccines.
Absolutely. Point-of-care testing is crucial. Vaccines is another topic we could spend quite a while on. You know, I brought my son to get his checkup yesterday with the pediatrician, and I asked how the vaccine conversations typically go. And she said, what's remarkable is that our county where we live, there's not been a case of measles, but literally across the river at the town we could see on the other side of the Hudson, there had been 250 cases, and it was an outbreak that's spreading in Rockland County. And she said, you know, the sad part is it's not even an interesting answer of why this is happening. It's just the vaccination rates differ dramatically. And one of the things I try to do is to meet people where they're at to understand what their fears and concerns are so that we can allay them. And, you know, when you mentioned Candida auris earlier in the program, when that story hit the New York Times, Chuck Schumer, one of our senators, said this is a federal emergency and that we need federal resource dollars to combat this fungus. And while I appreciated the sentiment, you know, I actually was thinking to myself, Candida auris isn't even in my top 20 of the most concerning infectious diseases that are in my environment. You know, we have patients with measles who are walking into our ER and potentially exposing hundreds of people. And combating the measles epidemic would be a good use of resources before we think about Candida auris.
What questions do you have about infectious diseases and superbugs? You can give us a call now at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. Here's Ann from Oakland. Ann, you're on.
Hi. So I have a very personal experience with the overuse of antibiotics when I was living abroad in a different country. It seemed like antibiotics were the only available medication. They were passed out like candy. I remember once I had a sore throat and the doctor gave me like three different types of antibiotics for it before doing any kind of testing. So my question is there any kind of have you looked into the overuse of antibiotics in developing countries, and is there anything being done to change that?
Great question. The short answer is that we have a lot of work still to do. And the reason for this is it's really a liability issue. Antibiotics work so well that doctors like to use them, and they like to pass them out to patients and say, you know, here's some Cipro, why don't you bring it, and if you have any diarrhea on your vacation, why don't you just go ahead and take it? And we found that now many of the different types of infections that happen on those vacation spots are from bacteria that are resistant to Cipro. And so one of the things moving forward that we need to be able to do is to have some accountability in the medical profession, that when people prescribe antibiotics, that there is some sort of feedback that this was wrong. And, you know, one of the callers earlier today said that their child was given antibiotic for a strep throat that they didn't have. And there's no accountability there. It's just said, oh, well, the kid got 3 days of antibiotics. That's too bad. And we need to fix that.
Now, the same problem with what you alluded to before is the opioid crisis, don't we? We're giving them out like candy.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I don't want to penalize my profession, but we need to have accountability that misuse of antibiotics can be a real public health threat, and you're really doing harm when you give antibiotics out like candy. This is something that I think the United States is going to be at the forefront of, and other countries will look to us following our lead. And so that's going to be something that we certainly will be tackling in the years ahead.
And let me thank Anne for her call. Here's Jane, who writes, I've recently begun a months-long struggle with bacterial vaginosis and have been on multiple rounds of antibiotics, both systemic tablets and vaginal gel. I also take probiotics every day. Nothing is working, and meanwhile, I feel my immunity declining. This sounds terrifying in the context of superbugs, and it's a problem many, many women are experiencing quietly in this country. What else can I do?
Absolutely. The most important thing to do is to see an infectious disease specialist. Bacterial vaginosis is something that some doctors diagnose without doing the proper diagnostic tests, and that can lead to inappropriate treatments. I've seen this many times. The key here is to make sure that you see a specialist. And as I alluded to earlier in the program, there are fewer and fewer doctors who want to be these types of specialists. But to get plugged in with somebody who knows what they're doing and can give you the right treatment is crucial. One of the reasons I wrote my book was to inspire people to become infectious disease specialists, because it's an incredible field. You do so much good. It's so interesting. It's one of the few fields where we continue to get more diseases. You know, as a cardiologist, there's only a handful of heart diseases. But as an infectious disease specialist, new types of infections pop up all the time. And so for the patient, I would say certainly ask your primary care doctor for a referral for an infectious disease specialist. The question about probiotics, patients have all different types of experiences with them. If your immune system is functioning properly, there's minimal downside to it. I occasionally see patients who have no immune system, who try a probiotic, and it gets into their bloodstream and causes real problems. So I typically say, when people say to me, what do you think of a probiotic? I say to them, what do you think of a probiotic? And then we have a conversation about how the data is limited and really isn't clear about how much it's actually going to help.
Here's Kim. Kim, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Great. Thank you. And thanks, Doctor, for bringing this aware to everyone. It's just kind of similar to the first question or the first caller, and that is I've been on an antibiotic now for at least 7 years, every single day, due to rosacea. And, the doctor seemed, it was pretty high milligram, too. So I wanted to go to Stanford, which I feel more like I have, they're more reputable doctors there. And they actually did bring the milligrams down. And they said as long as the milligrams are pretty low, taking an antibiotic every day should be okay. So I want to know what your thoughts are on that.
Oh, great question, Kim. Whenever I hear that somebody's been on an antibiotic for 7 years, I pause because that's a very long time. And there are some patients who need to be on lifelong antibiotics. We see this periodically where a patient has an infection in their spine, for example, and it just won't go away. And what we do is we give them what's called suppressive antibiotics to keep the infection from spreading. Now, what you're mentioning is a dermatologic condition, and usually it's the dermatologists who recommend lifelong antibiotics for that. I think it was good that you got a second opinion, that you were able to go down on the milligrams. It might be worth seeing an infectious disease doctor as well, because some patients can go on what we call an alternating schedule, where you get antibiotics for a month, and then you have a month off, and then you have a month on and a month off. And this keeps the bacteria on their toes, essentially, because one of the problems is if they get exposed to our precious antibiotics, they evolve and they create enzymes that can chew up antibiotics. And they have these microscopic vacuum cleaners they produce called efflux pumps that can suck up antibiotics and spit them out. And so by varying your treatment, it keeps them from making these enzymes. So, without knowing your case and having seen your skin, I hesitate to give you a firm treatment plan, but I would say it might be worth checking in with an infectious disease specialist to see if you could go on an alternating regimen where there are periods of time that you don't need any antibiotics.
Let me thank Kim for that call. And speaking of long-term course of antibiotics, here's a listener, Heather, who writes, how concerned should patients placed on longer-term courses of antibiotics, example Lyme disease, be about developing antibiotic-resistant bacteria?
Great question, Heather. I specifically wrote about Lyme disease in my book because it is one of the most confounding conditions for us to treat. We frequently see patients who have been treated for Lyme disease, and then they just don't feel better weeks and months and years after. And there's this very controversial condition called chronic Lyme disease. Some physicians say that it doesn't exist, and I have seen many patients who assure me that it most certainly does exist. And some patients get put on very long courses of antibiotics, even though their Lyme test is negative. There are a number of studies which show that patients don't always feel better after that long course of antibiotics. The unfortunate part for us is we don't know what really to do with these patients. And it's not so much a matter of treatment failure, but it's actually more a matter of a diagnostic failure, that we aren't able to give patients a firm answer for what's going on inside their bodies. And we have tried various antibiotics for chronic Lyme disease, things like doxycycline, penicillin, ceftriaxone, and the patients I've seen rarely feel that those long courses have been helpful. So in the years ahead, what we're going to be doing is focusing our efforts on getting better diagnostics to help patients understand just because the Lyme test is negative does not mean that you are infection-free or that you're all better. And we're hopefully going to have a new way to treat patients who experience these really agonizing symptoms.
Our guest is Matt McCarthy, MD. His new book is Superbugs, the race to stop an epidemic. And here is an anecdote from a listener named Emil who writes, I am 71 years old. My grandfather practiced medicine in the 1950s. He told my mother not to use antibiotics except in cases of pneumonia or other severe infections. He said they would become stronger. Why did he know that then, and it took 50 years for other doctors to figure this out?
Well, Emil hit on something really interesting, which is I'll give you a crash course in the history of antibiotics, which is that the first one, Alexander Fleming discovered penicillin.
You start your book with that.
That's right. And it was mass-produced in the mid-1940s. And it ushered in what we call the golden era of antibiotic development, which was the 1950s.
And forgive me, a kind of accident, really, when you think about it.
We stumbled, it was serendipity. And then the 1950s was this period where we were pumping out new antibiotics every few months, and the human life expectancy increased dramatically. And then something happened, which is that a number of prominent scientists came out and said, you know, we've got this infectious disease issue kicked. It's time to move on to more pressing issues like heart disease and cancer. And so the pharmaceutical industry moved away from creating new antibiotics and started focusing on chemo and different blood thinners and all different types of drugs. And that allowed the bacteria to mutate and to evolve into these superbugs. And we didn't recognize the scope of the problem until the 1990s. And by then, it was almost too late. And I want to end with offer a note of hope here, which is that it's not too late. We are at an inflection point where we can invest in new treatments and new diagnostics, and we can definitely conquer this issue, but it's going to take focused resources. And the first step is for people to just understand the problem so that we know how to attack it.
Always welcome ending on hope, and we can indeed leave it there. One quick question, though. Ron wants to know if you see any relationship between superbugs and climate change?
Oh, absolutely. I'll give you an example that I got this morning, which is that there are a number of drug-resistant fungi that are geographically localized, meaning that they only occur in certain parts of the United States. And one of them that I treat is something called Blastomyces, and it's just started to appear. It used to be in the Southeast, and now it's in upstate New York. Never been seen before there, but we're now having to confront the fact that these microbes are moving all around because the climate's changing.
Well, we will have to leave it there. And Dr. McCarthy, I appreciate very much your being with us. Thank you. Thank you for the work you've done, too. The book, again, is Superbugs, A Race to Stop an Epidemic. Appreciate, again, your being with us, Matt McCarthy.
Thanks for having me.
And appreciate you, our listeners, being with us Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. We are here with you. An hour is repeated in the evening, 10 to 11. You can continue this discussion online by going to our website, kqed.org/forum. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.